Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Decoding the Unknown. As always, I'm your host, Simon Wyams, here, one of my writers. In this case, David finished me a script. Drunken Ghost Hunters number 3, Return of the Jedi. I absolutely don't get the Star Wars reference. I guess a Jedi came back at some point. Not even sure what a Jedi is. I was thinking in my mind of Jedis, and I realized I'm thinking of Stormtroopers. So that's how little I know about Star Wars. The format of this show, I've never read this before, and this is a special episode. David occasionally writes these. He goes off and goes to some haunted location and has a few drinks. Usually a lot of drinks. This just does well. So we continue to do more of them, and David continues to go damage his liver. So that's nice. Welcome to episode 3 of Drunken Ghost Hunters. Indisputably the greatest show that ever graced the internet. You're goddamn right. It's the show where we go get drunk, go haunted places, act like assholes to provoke the ghosts, and then go back later in the daytime to scientifically investigate any paranormal phenomenon that we encountered. It's flawless, it's beautiful in its simplicity, and it really should be a live-action TV show by now. Netflix, where are you? Hello? Simon greenlit the first episode in the earliest, most experimental days of Decoding the Unknown. Yeah, when I first started a channel, I don't really know what's going to work. So, like, generally now, if David came to me with this as, like, an idea, I'd be like, no. But we did this when the show was just starting out, and when shows first start out, you just try loads of random stuff and see what hits, and then the stuff that hits, you continue to make. Surprisingly, this hit. So here we are. It was so successful that the show simultaneously won a Nobel Prize, cured polio, and was elected the president of El Salvador. El Salvador's really intense. Like, the president of El Salvador is really intense. I'm not so sure that I'd want to be the president of El Salvador. You'd have to deal with all those gangs. They probably want to kill you real bad. Full disclosure, to create the right atmosphere, I traditionally write the rough drafts of these scripts a little tipsy and then edit them with a headache the next morning. In this episode, we investigate a couple of haunted hotels and an entire haunted mining town over a multiple-day drunken bender in tropical North Queensland, Australia, on a road trip taking us to the locations of Townsville, Ravenswood, Charters Towers, and possibly a jailhouse drunk tank. Oh no... Our epic journey sweeps across the croc-infested swamps of the coast to the snake-riddled desert of the Outback. The results of our investigation are so startling there's an 80% chance they make your head explode. Nevertheless, regardless of the immense risks to the personal safety and mental well-being of our audience, we're so excited to finally reveal to you whether or not ghosts exist. I'll tell you right now, they don't. I mean, maybe they do, but there's absolutely no evidence to support it. Brace yourself, because the answer might surprise you. Somehow doubt it, David. Unless you thought they didn't exist, in which case, fuck it, you're right. That's exactly what I thought, David. Dramatis personae. Oh, hello there, my name is David, or Dave, I don't mind either way. I have a PhD and a few other similarly overpriced wall decorations, and I've taught at several universities over the past 15 years. Oh, you have, David, have you? Well, la-dee-fucking-da. I've got training in the natural and social sciences, including physics, evolutionary biology, and long-term trends in human history. I even worked on a multi-year research project on the thermodynamics of complexity with a famed astrophysicist from Harvard. Well, la-dee-diddly-da. My worldview can be defined as a rational materialist with just a smidge of agnosticism to avoid sounding too arrogant or going overboard. Yeah, I'd say I'm pretty much in the same field there. You don't want to be, like, too much of an atheist because it makes you sound arrogant, and it makes you seem like you know everything, whereas you probably don't. There's definitely things out there that you don't understand yet. I originally conceived the idea for Drunken Ghost Hunters as a goofy project that I could conduct with other researchers. We'd go to a haunted location, have a bit of a good time, and then return to science the shit out of anything we saw, and then we'd publish the results as an article in a minor academic journal that'd be read by 12 people. But displaying the concept in the form of a comedic entertainment script for thousands of people on the internet to joy while inadvertently revealing my tragic lifelong struggle with alcohol abuse was ultimately a much better outcome. Fucking savage. And so, we find ourselves here. As always, I'm joined on this Odyssey of the Cult by my intrepid colleague, Alexandra. She's got a PhD in ecology with an expansive knowledge of both evolutionary theory and human psychology. She now runs a wildlife management and pest eradication service in New South Wales. Wow, okay, that's a vibe. She's a 5'11" force of nature, having spent her life snorkeling, bushwalking, spearfishing, and hunting. 5'11"? That's how tall I am. That's pretty tall for a woman. That sounds sexist. But women are shorter. That's pretty tall for a woman. If I say it like that, it does seem... Stop digging the hole. She once got bitten by a redback spider, one of the most venomous arachnid in the world, and is such a tough lady that it's rumored that she poisoned the redback. She ain't afraid of no ghost, and if ever confronted with one, she'd either laugh derisively at it and tell it to piss off or punch it in the face. Alex lives in New South Wales, whereas I recently moved to North Queensland to enjoy the land of perpetual summer. In Sydney, it gets not cold, but irritatingly chilly in the winter, and the houses are basically like living in garden sheds, and I hate it.
David's like, what, living in Australia wasn't warm enough for you, David, was it? Was he? He had to move to the warm part of Australia.
It does sound really nice. I'm not jealous at all. In fact, the weather's really nice here right now, except my office is freezing cold. Because I was like, oh yeah, the weather's so nice, I'll turn off my heating for the summer. And then it got cold again. And now my office is cold. But I just turned on the heating and I know I'm going to come in tomorrow. It's going to be too hot. Well, why do I have to live like this? Why doesn't my thermostat work properly?
But Alex enjoys drunken ghost hunting so much that she kindly took the time to fly up here and join me. Fucking effort.
After all, these scripts just couldn't happen without her. In fact, I'm utterly convinced that Alex is the only reason why these scripts are actually funny. And fortunately, the airfares from Sydney to Townsville are only $100 or so. We'd spend more on our booze bill this trip. Far more. I can provide you with the receipts.
David's probably like, and I'll be providing you with the receipt, Simon.
Unfortunately, neither Jess nor Ryan were able to join us on this trip because they actually have lives, and neither of them really wanted to spend their holidays flying north, sweating in the summer heat, getting shit-faced for several days straight, and staying in dingy two-star hotels in the outback. David writes to me, I will briefly pause here to let you know that the shortest history of sex is out in America. I know I'm not supposed to read this, but this is my lazy way of doing an ad read. David has a book. As you can probably tell from his writing here, it's the shortest history of sex. Let me find my copy. Oh, it's available in America, the UK, Canada, Australia, India, and translated versions will be available in dozens of other countries within a few months. Here it is. This one. I think there's an American cover, which, dear editor, if you could put up on the screen, that'd be fantastic. So you could look for it in your favorite bookstore. And what's that? A foreword by me? Yes, that's right. It's a grand chronicle of everything related to sex from its first evolution 2 billion years ago to today. It explains where all the naughty bits and bedroom maneuvers and filthy instincts and weird fetishes came from. Simon wrote the foreword, as I did indeed. It's available for purchase at all fine bookstores and also on any major retail website online. You can also get an e-version for your iPad. Also, feel free to put a purchase link in the description. Okay, there we go. There's a link right there. We'll put it in the description. Go get David's book to maximize your viewing, listening experience. Because Simon stated several times in the last episode he wished he'd been there, I've had a few requests from audience members that I should encourage Simon to shoot this video at the end of the day when he might more feasibly be able to sit down with a beer or a glass of wine while filming. Yeah, David and I had a whole discussion about this via email trying to make this work. The problem is, I drive to work because I recently moved. And so now it's like, I get my car, drop my kid off at school, drive to work. And so I was like, well, I have to drive home from work, David. So I can't just like drink at work because they have a zero. You can't even have like a glass of wine here. It's like zero tolerance. So unless I wanted to drink in the morning and then wait for it to all wear off, which wouldn't exactly be a productive day, I just can't do that. And then David's like, oh, just take a taxi to work. And I'm like, yeah, David, but I have kids and they got to sit in the back and then they need car seats. And it's just a nightmare with car seats. So I'm having coffee. But we're going to have a great time anyway, don't worry. I will have already made this entreaty in the email that came with this script. Yes, he did. But Simon is a busy guy and shoots approximately 876 videos per day, including weekends, for his 12,000 channels. I may have to shoot this video in the morning. Indeed, I am. It's 11 a.m. Coffee. In which case, coffee will have to do, yes. But maybe if we close our eyes and pray really hard to Bacchus, the gods of wine, it'll turn into an Irish coffee. Not yet. But regardless, the audience has also requested that Alex and I travel to the Czech Republic sometime and do a drunken ghost hunters with Simon at a suitably haunted location in Prague.
David, I hate spoiling all your fun, but I can't drink that much these days because I'm on a drug that it doesn't agree with alcohol. It makes my liver all funny. So I like generally just have a couple of drinks nowadays, and that's kind of where it ends.
We have duly launched a fundraiser to pay for the airfares and have applied for a government research grant to pay for the hotel. I kind of believe that David would do this and somehow get that research grant. Additionally, Alex has taken up panhandling for change at railway stations, and I've started an OnlyFans account where you can catch a glimpse of my sweet, sweet ass. Full confession, in reality, I did try to set up an OnlyFans account a few months ago where I would only post pictures of air conditioning equipment that I screen capped off Google, but the verification process is demented and boring, and the AI didn't like the quality of the pictures I took of my face and passport, so I gave up. David, what are you thinking about? This time investment wasn't just worth it for one, lousy jokes. Still, online sex work is still a valid option for me, should this writer thing not work out. Welcome to Townsville. It's pronounced Townsville, apparently, not Townsville. Well, that's weird, and I'm definitely going to get that wrong. A few months ago, Alex hopped on a plane to join me in Townsville, North Tropical North Queensland. I moved up here from Sydney in May last year. I previously had lived in Sydney for a total of 12 years with a brief intermission where I lived in the Netherlands. The last four of my years in Sydney were spent in the beautiful suburb of Manly, which in my opinion is home to the nicest beaches in the city. Imagine Bondi Beach without as many hobos, hippies, and drug addicts. I don't even know Bondi Beach, but it doesn't sound nice. I live on a thin peninsula with the azure blue Pacific Ocean 2 minutes walk down the road from me and the glistening gentle waves of Sydney Harbour on the other side, 1 minute walk from me. I was a 19-minute fast ferry ride from the Opera House on the Harbour Bridge. The downside? Sydney essentially has New York prices. I was paying an obscene amount of money to live in what was essentially a former crack den that I wouldn't ask my worst enemy to take a shit in. And because Sydney houses are basically built like sieves with no insulation and substandard heating, you're never warm inside. And I hate winters. What's the point of moving to Australia if you're going to be cold 4 to 5 months of the year? What a ripoff. And so, I moved to Townsville, population 180,000. If you're wondering about the quaint and seemingly redundant sounding name, the place was founded in 1865 by a merchant and speculator named Robert Towns, who apparently didn't see the redundancy. Could have been worse, he could have named it Townstown, but Townsville is Australia's best kept secret. The tropical idol sits adjacent to the Great Barrier Reef and yet is not a tourist town. It's just a home of honest working stiffs, army blokes and biology students because it boasts one of the best universities on earth to study wildlife and one of the largest animal hospitals in the country. My dog Milo is spoiled when it comes to healthcare. Lucky Milo. Townsville is a smaller community compared to the giant metropolises of Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane, and yet it is large enough to have all the hallmarks of civilization, from Ubers to greasy takeout to overpriced gourmet meals. Smack dab in the middle of town is a gigantic pink granite monolith, Castle Hill, which is absolutely beautiful, and the city is ringed by verdant rainforest, volcano-forged mountains and brilliantly coloured tropical seas. The house prices are considerably cheaper than the big smoke of Sydney, and the people are nicer, and their elbows are less sharp, and winter, in any way, shape or form, just doesn't exist. My colleague, Alex, while a fan of nature, was born and raised in Sydney, and she has a little bit of disdain for the great untamed north. She considers it backward. She once asked me if I had met a girl up here with a proper number of eyes, ears, fingers and toes. Ah! Alex arrived in early November. She brought with her an infrared camera and the spirit box from our last ghost hunt. A spirit box is a bullshit device that shuffles through various radio frequencies, while the douchey hosts of ghost hunting shows imagine that they can hear the voices of the dead speaking to them. What is really happening is confirmation bias, if not outright fraud, where gargles and static are interpreted as voices the same way people see the face of Jesus or the Virgin Mary in a burnt piece of toast. Meanwhile, I already possessed the EMF detector, which supposedly looks for disturbances in the electromagnetic spectrum created by ghosts. In reality, you can trigger an EMF detector with television remotes, video game controllers, garage openers, and vibrating sexual aids. Of course you can, because those things actually emit EMF, whereas ghosts don't, because they're not real. I also kept the Ouija board and Necromicon from our last adventure in the Hunter Valley. I totally forgot about the Necromicon, or whatever even is it. I took Alex to my cozy little house alongside the Ross River and in the shadow of the picturesque cliffs of Mount Stuart. Although it is technically a three-bedroom house, I only use one as an actual bedroom. The rest is full of books, mementos, dog toys, and a 13-inch dildo I bought as a joke from a sex shop when I was drunk. So I gave my guest the bed, and I gallantly settled on the couch. Over the next few days, Alex puttered around Townsville while I finished up a casual criminalist script. I also managed to pry myself away from the laptop to show her a few hotspots. Alex declared that she liked the town and marveled at how the locals all seemed to have opposable thumbs and were walking on their hind legs. She's like, this is amazing. Shortly thereafter, she took the 13-inch dildo out of the packaging and chased me around the house, trying to slap me in the face with it. I'm just imagining David's exactly my age. And I'm just imagining in my mind that Alex is also exactly David's age and our age. And it's like, yeah, this is the sort of shit I would do. Because I'm a child living in a man's body. Except instead of slapping David in the face, I'll just be using it to hit him as hard as I could. I don't know why that's what came to mind, but it's exactly what I'd do. When I proved too fast, she bungled it at my head and scored a direct hit. After 3 days of this heartwarming camaraderie, it was time to launch the first phase of our operation. The West End Cemetery. According to paranormal investigators, Townsville, which boasts a private Facebook page with 98,000 members. What? Didn't you say there were 180,000 people in the town? 98,000 of the believing ghosts? They really are from the north. Presumably not all from Townsville. Nah, you gotta assume not, right? But also, why are people so interested in a random Australian town and its ghostliness? Well, according to them, the West End Cemetery is one of the most haunted areas in tropical North Queensland. Located on a plot of land just behind Castle Hill, it is the area's oldest such cemetery. The first body was buried there in 1868, 3 years after the founding of the town. It was Captain Henry Daniel Sinclair, who drowned at 50 years old in a sailing accident just off the coast. People continued to be interred in the West End Cemetery until the 1930s. The rows of faded gravestones surrounded by corroded old ironworks certainly do exude a sense of creepy gothic horror. Or at least it would if the cemetery wasn't located in a tropical paradise where it's sunny 300 days a year and it wasn't just down the street from a pub, a barbershop, and a friendly looking pet store. Yeah, this is the sort of stuff you're in the day and you're like, why would I ever think this is haunted? And then you're there alone at night and it's cold and rainy, you're like, ghosts are real, I'm sorry, I lied, they are real, please don't hurt me. Nevertheless, at night it's a reported hotbed of paranormal activity with orbs of light allegedly flitting from tree to tree, with plenty of disturbances picked up on the electromagnetic spectrum, and with the croaking of dead voices emitting from spirit boxes purchased nearby. People purchased for $90 via their Amazon Prime accounts, while the manufacturers presumably throw back their heads and laugh like jackals. One of the most frequently reported spectres in the West End Cemetery is the ghostly apparition of a man walking through the graveyard with an equally ghostly apparition of his dog. No word on whether the human uses ghost plastic bags to clean up translucent poos. Our preparations to visit the West End Cemetery were sophisticated, painstaking, and thorough. First, at 2 p.m. on the appointed day, we retired to the Ville Resort and Casino, donned our bathing suits, and spent roughly 3 hours lounging in the sun and ordering cocktails from the bar located in the swimming pool. We brought along with us the EMF detector, spirit box, an infrared camera in a canvas bag that also contained our clothes, sun lotion, and beach towels. People definitely think you weird. So what you did, just chilling by the pool having a cocktail while there's this weird box where you're like, hello, nice, dry 9995 out. You know, it's gonna be weird. I drank margaritas with tequila, contro, lime, and agave. I can't remember how many we had, but it was somewhere in the region of 3 or 4. You're gonna remember when you go check out the next day, they're like, okay, and now we'll settle up the bill, sir. And it's like, oh no, what have I done? It's so easy when you're on holiday at a hotel and you're just like, yeah, no, I'll have a lunch, I'll have another drink, and everything's super expensive, because of course it is. And then they just bring you thing, you know, like you sign it to your room, and it gets to the end of your trip and you go to pay for it and you're like, oh god, how bad is it gonna be? And I always like to set a really large number in my mind, so no matter how large the number actually is, I feel good about it. And I still don't. In order to avoid getting prematurely pissed drunk, we booked a table for 5:30 p.m. at Miss Song's Chinese restaurant, also located at the Ville, where we lined our stomachs with dumplings and sweet and sour pork. That sounds so good right now, I'm definitely hungry for lunch. Unfortunately, we thought it was a good idea to split a bottle of red wine. By this point, the volume of our conversation was rather loud, and the use of many demonetized normal words, the F word, the S word, the C word, when you are in Australia, became notably more frequent. I'm ashamed to say that at one point we incurred rather scathing looks from a family of four who were sat across from us, so we tried to tone it down with moderate success. You're in a family restaurant! Ah! I'll be like, oh god, if that was my, that is my family, like, there's two of us and our two kids. Fortunately, I think the kids are too, like, I swear around my kids too much. I'm trying not to, but they're still too young. Before leaving the Ville, Alex thought it was a great idea to dip into the casino for some cigarettes. Neither of us smoke them habitually, but we somehow felt the need for the extra nicotine, and Alex wound up playing the pokies while I pissed away $30 on a few rounds of blackjack. From there, we caught a cab. What is the pokies? Playing the pokies. I don't know what that is. From there, we caught a cab. However, due to our advancing state of inebriation, we thought it was a good idea to do a few detours before heading to the cemetery. You see, during our research, we'd found out that on Flinders Street, one of the oldest roads in Townsville, there were numerous haunted sites, many of them bars. Shall we explore the haunted graveyard? Or, I don't know, the haunted and still very functional bar? I'd be like, how about we try the bar? How about we skip the graveyard altogether and just tour the haunted bars? What had once been the town's high street had transformed into Townsville's party central, so we caught the cab there first. After alighting from the vehicle, alight is a word that I learned way too late in life. Like, I was riding on the London Underground one day, and one of the lines, for some reason, they're like, alight here for, you know, Oxford Circus or whatever. And you're like, okay, what does that mean? And it just means, get off. Like, can't you just say exit? It's like, alight. I think I learned that word in my 20s. From the vehicle, we walked past the Old Townsville Railway Station, another reputedly haunted site. We weren't allowed inside, but there have been reports of a ghostly apparition of a woman appearing on the train station's second floor balcony. We didn't see her, and Alex reported that the infrared camera also yielded nothing. Surprise! Frustrated, Alex shouted something to the effect of, "Come on and show us your tits, you are." Sorry, Australian. David told me a word that allowed you to do the Australian accent really well, which I don't remember. Australian name to get accent. It was Michael something. Michael, come on. Michael. Let's try Michael. Michael, come on. Ah, fuck it. Never mind. I can't find it. No Australian accent today, mate. Come on out and show us your tits, y'all, bitch. God, that was bad. I'm sorry. And I thought it would be best that we move on before we attracted the attention of the local constabulary. From there, we tried to appear as sober as humanly possible to get into the Mad Cow Tavern. No easy task after roughly 8 to 10 standard drinks. The Mad Cow is located in a building that first opened in 1887 as a quaint little hotel. It was now Townsville's most popular nightclub, rather than an actual tavern, usually filled to the brim with drunk university students. According to paranormal investigators Townsville, the earliest ghost sighting goes back to 1902, when two men saw the ghostly apparition of someone hanging from a noose attached to the rafters. Moving forward to the present, and being in my mid-30s in a nightclub filled with 20-year-olds, I fought off the urge to hang myself. Nevertheless, Alex and I settled in and drank a couple of schooners of beer and a glass of Fireball cinnamon whiskey. We did not see any spirits at the Mad Cow except the lines of booze bottles behind the bar, but we did take note that the MF detector was going off like crazy. But given we were smashed into a crush of Gen Zers, many of whom were taking selfies on their mobile phones, I think we can deduce what was going on there. Alas, no ghosts had been reported at the Show Bar strip club just down the street. From the Mad Cow, we staggered down the road to Molly Malone's Irish pub, where we'd read that a male ghost stands by the door to the kitchen and observes people in the bar. We entered and equipped ourselves with more beer and half a kilo of chicken wings, which we barely touched. Oh no, again, I'm so hungry. That sounds so good. Being an Irish pub, I had Guinness, despite it being summer, and Alex stuck to the local lager. We did not spot the ghost standing next to the kitchen with our bare eyes, nor did the EMF detector, and the infrared camera yielded no results. Needless to say, it was far too loud in there to use the spirit box. We did, however, discover a very much alive married couple in their 50s who confided to us that they were swingers. What is happening in your evening? They spent a few minutes trying to convince Alex to come back to their place for some fun. For some unearthly reason, they seemed less enthused about me. Alex quickly disposed of the phone number they gave her. So weird. By the time we poured ourselves out of Molly's, we were ready to investigate the West End Cemetery. We hopped in a cab. The driver seemed a little nonplussed at our choice of destination and pointed out that we really shouldn't be staggering around there in the middle of the night. I lied that we were going on a ghost tour and that everything was fine. When we arrived at the cemetery, I will admit that it looked creepy as fuck. A feeling that was all the more heightened by occasionally spotting a few flying foxes that swooped overhead. Is flying foxes a real thing? Because David once got me with the drop bears in Australia. And I was like, oh my god, that sounds scary. And apparently they're not real. Flying foxes? David, you trying to get me again? I'm very wary now. Flying foxes are, as the name implies, a gigantic flying bats with a wingspan similar in size to hawks. No, they're not. There's no bats that are that big. A deathly silence hung over the graveyard, punctuated only by the frequent sound of cars on the nearby highway. That would bring me comfort. Like, I'd be like, yep, remember, there's no such thing as ghosts. This is that highway. We built that with technology. Technology that has never discovered ghosts. As we walked amid the headstones, most of which appeared to be from the early 1900s, Alex flicked on the spirit box. A hiss of static filled the gloom. No discernible voice arose, but there was the occasional blip of some classic rock. Worried that someone would overhear the noise, Alex soon turned it off. The creepiest thing we encountered in the graveyard was a small plot of land that later research revealed was a mass grave of children who had died in an epidemic in the 1890s. Oh my god. But this isn't so much a paranormal sighting as it is a historical fact. We saw no orbs of light. We saw no ghostly outline of a dog taking a shit. The EMF and infrared camera yielded sweet Fanny Adams. Sweet Fanny Adams is such an old person. I remember my English teacher at school used to say, well, you haven't done your homework. It just seems you've been doing Sweet Fanny Adams all evening last night. And you'd be like, I just forgot. Sweet F.A.
It's an old person saying for doing nothing. It was largely a bust. Alex and I briefly discussed whether we should do anything to agitate the ghosts, but we came to the conclusion that given this was a graveyard, we'd essentially be hurling childish insults at the resting places of people of Townsville's great-grandparents. This did not sit right with us. So the worst agitations and ghosts received that night was a bit of public urination conducted at a respectful distance from the cemetery. And with that, we walked back toward the road, summoned an Uber, and after 15 minutes of waiting that seemed like forever, we headed home and crashed headlong into unconsciousness. The Imperial Hotel in Ravenswood. The following day budgeted for a horrific hangover, during which we ate pizza, chips, and salsa, binged-watched Breaking Bad for the 50th time, and generally bemoaned how we couldn't go to the beach or cafes or hike like normal people. Oh my god, the last time I binge-watched anything, I missed that. Like, since I had kids, it's like, it's always been like, now when if I wanted to watch something, I just feel bad about not working. I couldn't watch like 6 episodes of Breaking Bad, even though it's like, when I retire, whenever that is, I'm gonna binge the shit out of some TV. And then about 2 months later, I'll be like, suppose I should get a job, shouldn't I? Because I can't just binge TV for the next however many years. But it does sound nice. Maybe I'll take a sabbatical just to binge TV. I mean, now I've got kids, so I can't do that, but you know what I mean. Alex passed the first half of the day running back and forth to the toilet. I spent it on the couch in the fetal position with my dog Milo curled up in the crook of my legs. We concluded that, given we encountered no paranormal activity at the cemetery, there was no point going back there in the daytime to investigate, unless we wished to stare at a few patches of urine on the ground. Besides, the following day, we had a much more attractive prospect. The Melbourne Cup is a national Australian event that has been held pretty much every year since 1861, in which people dress up like they're going to the high school formal and get absolutely arse-licking drunk, and then go to the hospital to get their stomachs pumped. Really? I assumed it must have been some sort of sporting thing. There are also maybe some horse races involved. There you go. In there somewhere. Alex and I intended to go to the local horse track in Townsville to celebrate this venerable Aussie tradition. I've never been to the horse races. In a way, like, I don't... It both appeals to me, and it's one of those things where I'm not sure whether I'll like it or not. Like, I don't really like gambling, and I don't really like horses, but I can imagine you have quite a good day out of it. With, like, you go along with some mates, you bet on some horses that go and race, you lose some money, you have a few drinks. It sounds like, I don't know, that kind of sounds quite nice. Maybe I'll go sometime. Alex wore a flower-speckled sundress with spaghetti straps and adorned her head with a small decorative hat with a lace veil that she used on every Melbourne Cup day in the last 15 years. But the classy effect of her apparel was only slightly offset by the fact that she was wearing thongs on her feet because, quote, I am not wandering around a racetrack all day like a masochistic fuckwit in heels. Yes, fair play. Also, thongs, very different in the UK. Thongs is a type of skimpy underwear in the UK. Maybe in America as well, because there's that thong song by the guy's American, right? In Australia, it means flip-flops. To be honest, given her already towering height, she hardly needed them. Meanwhile, I donned a blue 3-piece suit, blue French dress shirt with white collar and cuffs, a purple tie, a leather black stalker hat, and a pair of reflective blue aviator sunglasses. Combined with the gigantic moustache I had at the time, this won me a number of high fives and back slaps from drunks at the race course for making the effort, though I'm sure I got the side eye from people who thought I was probably mentally ill, but in my opinion, damn, I looked good, and Twitter agreed, so fuck it. Whoever's editing this, find an image of David up on the screen now, look on his Twitter. I follow him, so you can find it on mine. There's only like 10 people or something. If you think it sounds like I should have been sweating bullets in that clothing all day, rest assured, I had already confirmed that we were going to be hanging out in a thoroughly air-conditioned room. There were no ghosts, demons, or poltergeists at the racetrack. Alex and I spent the afternoon drinking Jack and Coke highballs from cans. I received a reliable tip and won $50 on a horse. I also did get selected for and promptly lost the annual fashion contest. I suspect I was robbed, given the lackluster gentleman with a beer belly that I lost to. More accurately, I may have spoiled my chances of victory by being sarcastic to those at the fashion contest who bizarrely asked why I chose my blue sunglasses in particular for my outfit, which struck me as an intensely stupid question. I don't know, because my horoscope told me to, lady, what the fuck? I don't know, it's a good wall. It is a stupid question, but it's also like, I mean, who cares?
I can also report that I successfully chatted up one of the female winners of the fashion contest, though later Alex and I discovered that she made internet videos and took pictures that definitely weren't air conditioners. The afternoon ended with half a dozen drinks and a mass rendition by three people of Sweet Caroline, during which the middle-aged woman sat next to me banged our table so hard that it knocked over my can of Jack and Coke, spilling it down the front of my suit. Alex nearly pissed herself laughing. Another hangover day passed, during which we questioned our life choices. And then it was off for the next leg of our ghost hunt. We stocked the car with our paranormal equipment, along with a bottle of Maker's Mark, a bottle of Southern Comfort, and a 2-litre bottle of Coke, a bottle of Lemon Lime Bitters, and a Grand National Original Lager Beer, a 10-pack of alcoholic ginger beer, a box of shot glasses, a bottle of Smirnoff Vodka, a bottle of tomato juice with Worcestershire sauce and Tabasco, and a bottle of high-quality Patron Tequila for shits and giggles. That is an extraordinary amount of alcohol. God damn. Also, this was happening the next day, right? Not that evening. It's like, yeah, we got absolutely trashed at the horse races. And then we stocked the car with more alcohol and drove. I think the hangover day passing means that the whole day passed. They went to bed, slept, got up the next day. We also brought along a sufficient supply of snack food. While we were away, Milo was safely ensconced at the next door neighbors who owned three dogs, including a female Shih Tzu with whom Milo is in love. I would have brought him for the road trip, but unfortunately, a lot of Australian hotels aren't dog friendly. Alex and I lit out for the 90-minute drive south to the tiny country hamlet of Ravenswood, population 255. As we traveled, we watched the tropical rainforests quickly dissolve into arid, dry-looking grassland, peppered with a healthy dose of desert sand. Ravenswood is quite literally a ghost town. Back in the late 1860s, gold was discovered there, and the town's population quickly ballooned to 5,000 people. It remained a bustling gold mining town for several decades, but then, during the First World War, the mines of the town went into rapid decline, and the people who lived there quickly evaporated, like mists at dawn. They left behind a wealth of old 19th century hotels, shops, smokestacks, antiquated cars, steampunk-looking mining equipment, and country churches, all to fall derelict. This sounds super fascinating. I love this kind of just a place that's frozen in history, and all the old stuff is still there and abandoned. I find that super interesting. But our focus was on the Imperial Hotel, reputedly the eye of the storm when it came to paranormal activity in the town. The Imperial was built in 1901 along the railway with beautiful Belle Epoque architecture that reflected the prosperous Gilded Age of the time. And although the town was largely abandoned 100 years ago and the railway line cut, the Imperial still takes in guests today. The Impy, as the locals call it, certainly fared better than the Brown's Hotel across the street, which had 50 rooms until it burned down. All the remains of Brown's Hotel are the stone front steps, crumbling in an otherwise empty dirt lot. Meanwhile, the Imperial has 18 rooms, which are decidedly small and claustrophobic, with old iron bed frames that are mildly creepy. The hotel bar, however, is beautiful with wood panelling and decorative stained glass, reminiscent of the gracefulness of yesteryear. Numerous ghost sightings have allegedly occurred at the Imperial over the years. Paranormal investigators recently captured wisps of light with their night vision cameras, although if you look at the footage, the light is barely perceptible and could have easily come from the reflection off someone's watch or phone. It could have? What? A mysterious light coming from an actual light source or reflection? What? No way. It wasn't a ghost. Other guests have reported being pushed by ghosts, particularly in the notorious Room 11, and at the top of the stairs, to the second floor, is a portrait of a woman hanging on the wall who is allegedly the hotel's chief ghost. Also present is the spirit of James Delaney, who founded the hotel, only to die the following year, in 1902. The current owner of the Impy, a man named Dwayne, claims that ghosts have twice saved the hotel from burning down by appearing to him and warning him ahead of time of the danger. I wonder, I mean, with this, it's kind of like, well, yeah, because, like, this guy wants to, like, drum up business for his hotel, and it's interesting if there are stories. Of course, they're embellished. He also claims that his son sat at the bar downstairs for a whole evening drinking rum and chatting with a man who turned out to be a ghost. In that case, I think your son either needs to get A, a carbon monoxide detector, or B, see a psychiatrist. Unfortunately, you can't really trust the word of a hotel's proprietor about ghost sightings since it can drive tourist traffic, especially in a town in the middle of nowhere with not much else to recommend it. Although if the owner genuinely believes this stuff, one cannot also rule out superstition or mental illness. Or carbon monoxide, get a detector. Also, it's possible that his son just drank too much rum one evening. I mean, yes, but also, I've never been so drunk that I was just having a conversation with nobody. Upon arrival, Alex and I felt slightly ridiculous for having packed so much booze in the car, since we sat in the pub for 2 hours drinking beer and lining our stomachs with some admittedly delicious pub grub. No ghostly apparitions joined us at the bar. We retired relatively early to room 11 because we're not fully recovered from our previous debauchery. But to not let things go to waste, we brought the bottle of bourbon, the lager, and the ginger beer to our room. We set an alarm for 12 a.m. and fell asleep for a few hours. It took us a while and several hits of the snooze button to rouse ourselves in the middle of the night. Alex popped down the hallway to the communal shower. Whoa. A hotel with a communal shower?
It's been a long time since I stayed in a hotel with a where there's not an ensuite bathroom. Damn!
Then we both had a shot of bourbon. Alex proceeded to nurse an alcoholic ginger beer, and I sipped my lager. That first drink, when you're hungover, or just don't feel like drinking, is so hard. You're like, oh, ah, ah. But then the second one's a lot easier. And then you're on your roll. The EMF reader went off depending on where we stood in the room, but turning on the lights, we figured it coincided with our proximity to an electrical outlet. The infrared camera revealed nothing unusual, and we detected no orbs of light, nor were we pushed by any ghosts. At one point, Alex and I exited the room and stood in front of the portrait of the chief ghost woman. Alex muttered that she looked like a hoe. In fairness, it was a decidedly inaccurate appraisal, and this did not provoke a supernatural response. We went back to the room and spent a few minutes listening to the spirit box, but it was difficult to incentivize spending long with it since we both knew it was bullshit. We made our way through a can or two before we gave up and slowly drifted back to sleep at around 2 a.m. I dreamt a hazy dream of a woman with a parasol chasing me through Sydney Airport. It's a ghost, David. The only reason you're having this dream is because you're in a ghost hotel. Perhaps it would have offended the ghost of the woman in the portrait after all. At least I could have irrationally concluded that until the woman turned into Aubrey Plaza and started eating a bag of popcorn. What, who's Aubrey Plaza? After several days of sporadic alcohol abuse and sleep deprivation, it is hardly surprising I had vivid and confusing dreams. It's not exactly proof of the existence of a spirit world. I was awakened at 5 a.m. by Alex holding her phone next to my ear, playing the annoying viral video Baby Shark on YouTube. Oh, God. So mad, my kids love that shit. Could have been worse. Could have been Johnny, yes, Papa. Never heard of that one. I get up. Is that, oh my God, is that a Cocomelon reference? I hate Cocomelon. I don't let my kids listen to Cocomelon because it's so stupid. I glared up at Alex, who had a shit-eating grin on her face. Apparently, I'd been grumbling and talking in my sleep and she wanted to mess with me. I told her to fuck off and she replied, no, you fuck off. I rolled over and drifted back to the land of Nod, vaguely searching for Aubrey again. I awoke a few hours later, miraculously, without any trace of a hangover, but the MP Hotel had been a bit of a bust. No paranormal activity, no ghouls, no specters, no demons, no blood orphans, no ominous voices in the dark, not even a flicker of light for a couple of microseconds on a videotape that would make a regular ghost hunter jizz themselves. It was almost like ghosts didn't exist and all the stuff was bullshit. Oh, it was it, David? I wonder why. But we couldn't be sure. Maybe ghosts are just shy. Either way, it was time for the next leg of our ghost hunt. The world of Charters Towers. We set off down the Finders Highway to the southwest and deeper into the interior of Australia. On either side of the road was more flat, dry grassland, sprinkled with a liberal dose of desert sands. Not quite the outback, but getting there. The dry landscape stretched on endlessly toward the horizon as far as the eye could see. Additionally, I could make out enormous herds of cattle in the distance. Not surprising, land this dry is only good for grazing. At least the arid landscape was livened up to some extent by some hardy eucalyptus trees, the canopies of which were a deep green contrasting against the pale, sun-baked wastelands. Fun fact, 12 people have just straight up disappeared on the Flinders Highway since 1970 and presumed to have been murdered. Good God. Some people speculate that there might be a serial killer living in the area, but in all likelihood, a serial killer is going to waste way more than 12 people in 50 years. Yeah, it just sounds like there's murders. People murdering people on the highway is what it is. It's much more likely the disappearances are all unconnected murders. If you kill someone out here and bury their body in the sand a few miles from the road, it's just extremely unlikely that someone will ever stumble across the shallow grave, ever. After an hour, we approached the town of Charters Towers, population 8,000. In 1871, a 12-year-old Aboriginal horse attendant who was accompanying some prospectors found a nugget of gold in a nearby creek bed. This kicked off a gold rush and people flooded the area. It turned out that there were enormous gold deposits in the region. By 1877, the town of Charters Towers was established, and despite being in a rather inhospitable environment, its population ballooned to 30,000 people, making it the largest town in Queensland after Brisbane, which had 40,000 people at the time, and Townsville's population was just a piddly 4,000. Due to the immense amount of wealth in Charters Towers, people imported all manner of luxuries, and the townsfolk began to refer to Charters Towers as the world, because everything one could possibly want was in the town. However, much like Ravenswood, the mining industry began to decline around 1899 and died a death during the First World War. People began to flee the world for greener pastures. Given the desert-like conditions, this was sometimes literal. Nevertheless, Charters Towers managed to stay afloat as an important hub for the livestock trade, which is why a hardy kernel of 8,000 people still call it home today. Wow, that's a lot less. So there were 30,000 people originally, and now there's just 4. There's going to be some, like, really cool old abandoned shit. Which, again, like I say, I'd love to see this stuff. Alex and I crossed a beautiful bridge over the Burdekin River into town, and I have to say that my impression of the place was immediately favourable, and it remains so. A lot of people like to shit on small Australian towns, but as someone who spent far too much of his life in cities, unlike the surrounding environment, the irrigation from the Burdekin River has made Charters Towers a bit of an oasis filled with tropical greenery. Furthermore, the beautiful Victorian architecture from the town's golden age glistened beautifully in the sun. I mean, when you build your post office to look like the fucking Taj Mahal, you know your town's economy is doing well. So Charters Towers gets top marks from me as far as small towns go. The weather really would be the only choking point for most people. Things were hot. Really hot. About 40 degrees Celsius or 104 Fahrenheit. God damn. That is so hot that you're just like, I gotta be inside. I just gotta be in the air conditioning all the time. But we've already established I love heat, perhaps as a result of growing up in Canada and getting sick of minus 40 and 6 feet of snow. Alex's praise remained more muted, but she did love the Victorian buildings as I did. Minus 40 is rubbish, but so's plus 40. I don't like either of those. I just want like a nice 25, 26, like all year round. That'd be pretty ideal. We arrived in town early in the day, and we weren't going to sit around day drinking. If we did that, we'd be passed out by nightfall and not see any ghosts. So after dropping our bags off at the hotel, alas, not haunted, we hopped across the street to the bakery for a pastry and a cup of coffee. Then we drove around the town for a bit in a thankfully air-conditioned car and admired the aforesaid palatial Victorian buildings. Afterward, we went up Tower Hill, which affords a view of most of the town, and sat at a picnic table in the shade and cracked open our first beers of the day. From there, we headed to the outskirts of town to look at some of the old gold mine, which were these layered craters in the earth about 30 or 40 feet deep and with the diameter of a couple of football fields. They're giant pockmarks on the landscape. The mines were, of course, no longer in use. The bottom one of the pits had flooded, and I could see that with minimal effort, these mines could be transformed into man-made lakes. At dusk, we swung by the Venus Battery, a gold processing plant established in 1872, which is reputedly haunted by the ghosts of its former workers. It was a rather unappealing-looking building made of beams of creaky timber, brick, and a shell of rusting corrugated steel. But what you want, it's a fucking factory, and it looked vaguely menacing in fading light. Not only was it nightfall, but it was the off-season, so we couldn't get a tour of the place. So for legal reasons, I shall say, that we simply got within reasonable proximity of the building in order to conduct our investigations. Scans with our EMF detector yielded nothing, but we did note some heat signatures near one of the stamp presses. This seemed like an ideal place to agitate the ghost, so we flicked on the spirit box, cracked open a couple of cans of alcoholic ginger beer, and started uttering abuse at the dearly departed workers. Stupid shit like, you losers worked in a factory. You should have become hardworking TikTok dancers and Instagram models like the rest of us. And how does it feel to have worked yourself to the bone so that your bosses could get rich? And stamp faster. You call that gold stamping? I could stamp more gold than you did before breakfast, you fucking cucks. I love the insult, cuck. It's just such a good, it's so good off that I like you fucking cuck. As you can tell, we were admittedly scraping the bottom of the barrel. What does one say to an anonymous gold processing worker? So eventually our agitations just petered off into everybody's glad you're dead, including your mum and the occasional fuck you ghosts, as we made our way back to the car, having detected no paranormal phenomenon. Again, what a massive surprise. But then suddenly, Alex had a stroke of genius. She asked me, most of these workers would be men, right? And they'd be shipped in, either single or working for their families back home, right? And I replied that this was, yes, likely. And without a moment's hesitation, Alex turned around, faced the battery again, lifted up her shirt, and quickly flashed the posthumous laborers. We immediately scrambled to see if it provoked a reaction. Alas, the infrared camera and spirit rocks yielded nothing. Alex was crestfallen. She was rejected by a bunch of dead guys, and that's got to sting. I tried to tear her up, saying, maybe they just really love their ghosty wives. Alex shrugged and replied, maybe the only ones that became ghosts were gay. It's such a drunk joke. We hopped back into the car and drove 10 minutes back into town, slamming the vehicle into the curb while we were attempting to park. Wait, you guys are driving? Wait, what? I totally did pick up on that. For legal reasons, I'll state for the record that we both had under 0.05% alcohol content in our blood, and now we were ready for the main attraction, the Royal Private Hotel. You're slamming it into the curb. David. Drinks with Mrs. Corday. The Royal Private was a two-star hotel on Mosman Street with eight rooms over a rather expansive bar on the first floor. First opened in 1888, its architecture is reflective of the grandeur of the gold mining era. A triangular building constructed in the Australian colonial style, it has the signature wrought iron railings ornately detailed on the second floor. For perspective, the architecture vaguely resembles building in the French Quarter of New Orleans. The downstairs bar, meanwhile, exudes old-world charm. The Royal Private Hotel has been bought and sold several times over the years, most recently by a mining company that refurbished the place in the hopes of reselling it at a 10% profit. A month after our visit, the Royal Private was sold, and I'm sure soon it will once more open its doors. At the time of our visit, however, there was no hope of staying the night or even flouncing into the downstairs bar for a drink. We instead had to book a hotel further down the street. However, with a great deal of foresight, a few phone calls in the preceding month, and above all a small fee, we were able to gain access to the building for a couple of hours to do some investigating. And it was worth it, because it was here, in the bar of the Royal Private Hotel, that a gruesome double murder took place. And if local legend is to be believed, one that set off over a century of extreme paranormal activity. On May the 7th, 1901, a man and two women walked into the bar of the Royal Private Hotel, a Mr. and Mrs. Corday and a Mrs. Munday. Mr. Corday called out to the barmaid for three glasses of beer, but this was no ordinary round of drinks. All was not well in the Corday's marriage. Mrs. Corday had been seen in the company of numerous questionable gentlemen about town and was likely having multiple affairs. Furthermore, Mrs. Corday seemed to have a lingering attachment to her ex-husband, a Mr. Bass, who lived in Brisbane. This created an immense amount of jealousy in Mr. Corday, along with a great deal of humiliation, because Mrs. Corday's indiscretions were widely known. Such was the friction in their marriage that Mrs. Corday refused to live with her own husband, and that would obviously facilitate her own infidelities. The drinks were ostensibly to sort out some mediation between the married couple and mend broken fences. However, unbeknownst to Mrs. Corday, her husband had earlier attempted to buy some cyanide with the intent of poisoning her. You're going to mend those fences with some cyanide. But he was unsuccessful. When the barmaid brought over the drinks, Mr. Corday took out a revolver. Mrs. Corday screamed. Her husband shot her in the head. Then Mr. Corday turned the gun on himself and shot himself through the heart in the ultimate symbolic gesture. Mr. Corday died at the scene while poor Mrs. Munday and the barmaid looked on in horror. Since then, a raft of paranormal activities have been reported by the Royal Private Hotel's guests to the extent that platoons of paranormal investigators have shown up to the place in previous years to lay eyes on the specters. Guests have reported strange noises in the night, footsteps on the stairs, and people walking past their bedroom doors. I challenge any of you to explain that without making recourse to ghosts. Other hotel guests walking past your door, perhaps. Except, you know, if the noises were made by living people in the hallways and on the stairs. Yes, like other guests. But who would believe such a crazy poppycock explanation? Oh, and there's more. Guests have reported lights turning on and off and doors opening on their own. And multiple witnesses who stayed at the hotel have reported hearing a woman's voice coming from the downstairs bar long after closing time. This, no doubt, must be the dearly departed Mrs. Corday. No doubt. Tragically cut down in her prime while her loins were still full of fire. Either by virtue of passion or an undiagnosed venereal disease, or it could have been the hotel's owner who from 2017 to 2022 was female. Potato, potato. Alex and I were let into the building by a kindly middle-aged man named Keith, who was acting as a real estate representative for his company. At first, we worried that he would stay to observe our investigations, which would have hamstrung us fatally. We had neglected to mention that we were the drunken ghost hunters, but apparently Keith found the whole paranormal thing so tiresome that he told us he'd be waiting outside in his truck and to call him when we were done. This was fortunate because in the bag carrying our ghost hunting equipment, we had secreted the bottle of Maker's Mark, two shot glasses, and two cans of beer. I do enjoy Maker's Mark. We had a time limit of 2 hours to get to work. Alex and I sauntered over to the refurbished bar and started off by having a shot of whiskey. Then we cracked open two tinnies of beer, the same beverages that Mr. and Mrs. Corday had been drinking when they died. Perhaps this would trigger some netherworld juju and bring forth the ghosts. We sipped our beers as we wandered around the bar area, which was quite resplendent and stocked with furniture from a very recent real estate viewing. I was about a quarter of a way through my beer when Alex nudged me toward another shot of whiskey. We then embarked on a series of insults of Mrs. Corday that I hesitate to record here for fear of getting in trouble on YouTube for slut-shaming. Please remember that ghosts don't exist, so no one could possibly have been offended, but rest assured our invective included everything from daddy issues to taking it up the bottom. After several minutes of this, we took our ghostly equipment and tried to detect any disturbances. There was nothing. Zip, zilch on the EMF infrared or the spirit box. Shocking. It was at this point that Alex began to fret that we'd have fuck all to report for this episode of Drunken Ghost Hunters. I reminded her that ghosts don't exist, so that was kind of inevitable, and also kind of the idea. We then headed upstairs to the bedrooms. Most of them were locked, but at the end of the corridor, one of the rooms had been left open. It was pretty, considering it was only a 2-star hotel. It was filled with cozy-looking new furniture that was nevertheless designed to look like it had been crafted a century ago. In fact, the only thing that gave away the reality that this was a 2-star hotel was the carpet, which was decidedly thin and cheap and darkly colored to avoid repeated cleaning and removal of spills and vomit stains from drunken guests. Yet, you get that in low-budget accommodations. Yes, you do. We stopped in the middle of the room and stood in silence for a moment, listening to the downstairs to see if we could hear signs of Mrs. Corday, but all we heard was the occasional car passing down Mosman Street. We headed back downstairs and finished our beers. I looked at my phone. Roughly 45 minutes had elapsed since we'd been let in there, and Alex and I did another shot of whiskey, chatted a bit longer, and exited the building. We didn't bother calling Keith, just walked straight up to his truck and told him we were done. He seemed surprised and asked half-heartedly if we found anything. Alex said no. I also remember Keith kind of looking at us funny, and the odds were pretty good that he realised that we were a bit drunk. But if he did, he didn't say anything. Good man, Keith. The Staggering Tour. From here, things get a little hazy. We had missed the season for Charters Towers Walking Ghost Tour, which takes you across the odd part of the city. It's too bad, but Alex couldn't get away from work during the winter or early spring. But we had done our research on the town, nutted up, and done a bit of a walking tour of our own. Or a staggering tour, if you will. And I bet your average ghost tour doesn't allow you to surreptitiously take a bottle of whiskey out of a canvas bag and drink from it, which, for legal reasons, we absolutely didn't do. Wait, can't you drink out in public in Australia? Is it one of those weird places where it's like no drinking in public and you have to drink out of a brown bag or whatever, like in America? Less than a block from the Royal Private Hotel is the Stock Exchange Arcade, a building that looks like an old-timey movie theatre. And the reason why it existed is because during the Gold Rush, Charters Towers became so wealthy that it had its own stock exchange. God damn! The building, there was like 40,000 people here. It's got a stock exchange. The building, however, was of interest to us because witnesses had allegedly seen the ghost of a woman dressed in white in front of the building. We saw nothing, but Alex spent a good long time wandering around the place, trying to, quoting her, find that fucking slut. We doubled back when we realized that we'd walked past Henry's Restaurant, which had previously been the site of Bright's Mining Exchange. At the location on the 10th of July, 1901, Graham Haygarth, the chairman of Charters Towers, Charters Towers Pyrites Company, had been shot dead during an executive meeting by works manager David Brown. God damn! The past, everyone. It's like, they don't do unions. It's just if the employees are upset, one of their representatives will just shoot one of the executives. Haygarth had recently informed Brown that due to the drying up of gold in the region and the failure of their new mining practices, that salaries would be cut across the board for labourers. Brown was apparently enraged with this, burst into the room, and shot Haygarth in passion's white heat. Alex took out our phone and started playing Rage Against the Machine's Ashes in the Fall, while we both did commie fist salutes and shouted Workers of the World Unite in hopes of triggering a response from either Haygarth or Brown. But at this point, we were beginning to attract attention from other pedestrians, so Alex quickly turned off her phone, and we hurried down the street as fast as we could, Alex giggling as we walked.
I just assumed you guys were inside, rather than just on the street listening to music on your phone. I always give those people the side eye, like, hey, I hate that.
What happened next is somewhat difficult to explain and will need a bit of backstory. Prior to leaving Townsville, Alex and I caught a few minutes of the 1935 Shirley Temple movie Curly Top. In the film, Shirley Temple has a pet duck. Yet, whenever the adorable child actress said the word duck, it kind of sounds like they're saying dick. This tickled our funny bones, and over the course of the next few days, with the aid of liberal doses of alcohol, this somehow transformed into Alex Isle saying in babyish voices, "My dick is a real dick." It's not a very clever joke. It's not even technically a joke at all. It's just fucking demented enough to make us laugh.
Yeah, these are the things you have with friends, right? Where it's like, it's not even funny. But it's like, you find it funny because of the lore around it.
The phrase reached its climax during the dildo incident I described earlier, but we sometimes said it randomly during the drive down to Flinders Highway. As we staggered down Mosman Street, crossed the road at the Red Rooster and walked down Mary Street, we started shouting, "My dick is a real dick." "No, your dick is fake. My dick is a real dick," at each other in mock angry tones, capturing the attention of passers-by. You guys are getting drunk. After two blocks, we looped around onto Dean Street and continued shouting our new catchphrase. We were headed toward the Miner's Cottage, a cute little house in the Australian colonial style, built in the first decade of the 20th century and preserved through the years until it was turned into a museum in the 2000s.
You guys sound like you're perfectly in the right state to be in a museum right now.
It's said to be haunted by the ghost of its owner, Jeannie Elizabeth O'Kane, who was born in Ireland in 1859 and came to Charterstown as a schoolteacher at 20 years old and met her husband in the goldfields 2 years later. Jenny O'Kane's husband then ran a local newspaper in Charters Towers for a number of years, dying in 1890. Jenny continued to be a pillar of the community until her death in 1936. There's nothing particularly tragic about her death. She lived a good life, passing away at the age of 77. But naturally, because the Miner's Cottage is an old house and a tourist location, of course it's gotta be fucking haunted. Yeah, I mean, get that tourist money, go, go, go. Alex and I arrived in front of the cottage. It was getting late, and I rummaged in our canvas bag for the EMF detector. Alex, meanwhile, took out her phone, put on Katy Perry's Firework, and began singing it at the top of her lungs. The only reason I know that song is because of the movie The Interview. The guy's like, "You like Katy Perry too?" After a moment's hesitation, I joined in, and we belted out the song in the middle of the street. Though I didn't really know the words, and I mumbled a little during the verses, and then came back loudly and enthusiastically during the chorus. It was at this point that a police officer approached us, asked us for our names, where we were from, and what we thought we were doing, and then politely suggested that we go back to our hotel. Still, with enough clarity of mind to realize that an ill-timed or aggressive statement could force the evening to take a tragic turn, Alex and I agreed, and we took off down the road. After a couple of blocks, we were confident that the constable was no longer observing us, so Alex grabbed her phone and started playing All Star by Smash Mouth. I'm ashamed to say that both Alex and I know the song by heart. David, I'm ashamed to say that I also know that song by heart. Somebody once told me the world. I'm not going to sing the whole thing, but I do know all of the words. I don't know why I'm admitting this. It's embarrassing. For some reason, I memorized it as a kid and have never shaken the words out of my head. David and I are the same age and we have the same stories, even though we grew up in totally different places. We made it the four blocks back to our hotel next to Listener Park without further trouble and only embarrassed ourselves in front of at best guest half a dozen more people. There, we made the mistake of drinking more, including cracking open the bottle of Patron tequila to mix with the lemon-lined bitters. Neither of us made it through a single glass, and the even more costly mistake of opening a 375 ml demi-bottle of red wine from the minibar. Uh-oh, that's gonna be expensive. At this point, I blacked out. But we must have spent several more hours drinking and talking, because when I woke up the next morning, it was 10 a.m, and usually when I'm hungover, I wake up at the crack of dawn and am unable to get back to sleep. Yeah, same here. If I'm like properly going to be hungover, I wake up early, and it's miserable. A late rise usually means a late night and a particularly savage round of drinking. While Alex was still comatose, I staggered to the bathroom, still feeling slightly drunk and not yet sick. I knew the sensation would not last. I took care of a cool of nature, splashed some water on my face, filled a glass with tap water, and retired back to bed, where I aimlessly scrolled my phone. Luckily, we had intended to stay for 2 days in Charters Towers. We had budgeted for either some daytime investigations or a massive hangover. In this case, the budget was somewhat unsurprisingly taken up by the latter. At around noon, I hit the agony phase of my hangover, and Alex spent half an hour dry heaving. At 2 p.m, we left our room and walked down to the Red Rooster. The heat of the sun made me feel like grim death, and I was racked with irrational anxiety and a perfectly rational shame from the night before. Yeah, the like hangover anxiety, like, why am I so anxious right now? That wasn't something that I got until my 30s, and it's like very unpleasant. At the Red Rooster, we had some chicken burgers, fries, and gravy to soak up the agony. We then returned to the hotel and watched a mixture of TV and movie videos on my laptop. A blissful night's sleep erased all of our hangover woes, and the next day we returned to Townsville. Alex stayed for a further week, during which I'm happy to announce neither of us touched a single fucking drop of alcohol. But both of us knew that this wasn't going to last. Conclusion. If there is one thing that our investigation in North Queensland has proven, it is that Alex and I are horrendous alcoholics who invented an entire YouTube genre as an excuse to binge drink and, well, we need to go to rehab. If there are two things that our investigation proved, it's that ghosts don't exist. We encountered fuck all during our investigations at multiple locations, so rest easy. You don't need to be afraid of ghosts. Downside, there probably isn't an afterlife, so we're all going to die and fade into dark oblivion, our entire existence being rendered meaningless by the eventual absorption of the Earth by the Sun in a few billion years and the ultimate death of the universe. Ah, so no spooky ghosts, but a kind of terrifying existential crisis. What fate gives us with one hand, she takes away with the other. However, there is an alternate explanation for why Alex and I did not encounter ghosts on our bender. Perhaps drunkenness and clumsy attempts to trigger anger in ghosts evokes a sort of raw emotional energy that scares the ghouls off. Ah, yes, that's it. That's the reason. Perhaps one needs to be more, quote-unquote, receptive to paranormal energies. AKA be stone cold sober, already believe in ghosts, desperately want to find proof of their existence, and already be terrified while standing in a spooky location in the dark. Yes. Cringe. Furthermore, perhaps all the ghosts we tried to find that week were on holiday, having been invited by the baby Jesus, Odin the Tooth Fairy, and Dora the Explorer to go for a luxury cruise on the River Styx. Who can say which explanation is the real truth? One thing is clear. More investigation is required, and more drinking, much more drinking. So expect the triumphant return of drunken ghost hunters to your computer or phone screen sometime in the future. Our liver's loss is your incontrovertible gain. And that's where we end today's episode. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you, David, for making the sacrifice. And Alex, well done. Bravo. Ghosts aren't real. And I'll see you next time.
Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery. Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the roaring 20s. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device, or play on PC through Facebook Games.